now working remotely from Detroit for a DC-based think tank. We all had our own kids now, 5 little ones between us. The last time the three of us had been together was my wedding, and we shared a few jokes about that. Wedding planning had been agonizing for a number of reasons, but mostly due to my powerful aversion to the traditional wedding style of Detroit area Chaldeans, the Iraqi Christian sect to which both Elliot and I belonged. Chaldean weddings are big fat Greek weddings on steroids, with debka dancing, Arabic pop music, professional belly dancers, and always a high-end open bar for up to 1,000 guests. Hummus, baba ghanoush, and tabbouleh are followed by a full-course meal that doesn't start until 10 p.m., usually consisting of many types of kebab and saffron-infused rice. Leaving a wedding, or any kind of Iraqi party, without being absolutely stuffed is unheard of. Refusing to eat any of the multiple courses is a grave insult. For dessert, the yummiest weddings will have baklava from Shatila Bakery in Dearborn, along with a traditional wedding cake. But that kind of extravaganza didn't really fit with my lifestyle or worldview, or Elliot's. So we spent our minimal wedding planning hours dreaming up ways to upend tradition, which was how we came to throw our reception in the Detroit Science Center. We invited our guests to Mona and Elliot's science project, and instead of the wedding march, we asked Elin, a pianist, and her husband, Mauricio, a cellist, to play the theme to The Princess Bride when I walked down the aisle. And rather than the usual 2 dozen bridesmaids and groomsmen, our small wedding party consisted entirely of immediate family members. My brother Mark and his wife Annette were my maids of honor. Elliot asked his sister Angie and brother John to be best men. The whole thing turned out to be a wonderful and fun experiment, except I will never live down setting the church on fire. Annie was singing Schubert's Ave Maria, her hypnotic soprano voice flowing through the church. Elliot and I were standing together, looking at Father Frank on the altar. We were calm and taking everything in stride. I was a young pediatric resident beginning my life with another pediatrician, a creative and sensitive guy. Before we met, I had 3 rules of dating. 1, no doctors. 2, no Chaldeans. And 3, no Republicans. Elliot was 2.5 out of the 3. Raised in a conservative family, he admits that he once voted for a Republican. But the force of his charm and romantic persistence won me over. The ceremony itself was straightforward, and now before us, on an altar cloth, were 2 small candles, both lit, representing Elliot and me. In the middle was a large candle that wasn't lit. As Father Frank had instructed during the rehearsal, we were each supposed to take a small candle and together light the big one. This act would symbolize our union. The week before, I had successfully performed my first spinal tap on a newborn. Light a candle, piece of cake. We lit the big candle in the middle of the table without incident. Then, as I tried to make sure my little candle was safely returned to its holder, I must have pressed down on it too hard. I'm not known for my light touch. My handshakes are notoriously firm. The candle toppled over. Within seconds, the altar cloth was in flames. Elliot reflexively tried to put the fire out with his hand and burned his fingers, while Annie's singing of Ave Maria seemed to grow louder, fueled by our little inferno. Flames were leaping. Smoke was now rising around us. Then I heard Mark's deep voice bellowing behind me. He couldn't stop laughing. Others in the pews began to chuckle. I turned around to see the face of my mom. Sheer horror. Amid the smoke and Mark's infectious laughter, Father Frank frantically smothered the flames. Elliot and I just looked at each other, smiling. He grinned through the pain of singed fingers. Elin, Annie, and Mauricio played on, flawlessly, in perfect harmony, as if nothing were happening. We wanted an unconventional wedding, and we got one. So here we were, more than 10 years later, standing around the flames of the smoky Kamado grill while Elliot cooked the chicken. To honor the reunion of the survivors of our wedding fire, we opened a bottle of wine that Elliot and I had brought back from our sort of honeymoon 10 years before. I say sort of because even back then, I couldn't fully unplug from work mode. I combined a honeymoon with a pediatric residency rotation at the American University of Beirut Medical Center. The wine was Kassara, from the famous vineyard in Lebanon, We had saved it for a special occasion. Not being wine connoisseurs, though, we didn't know about its short shelf life. After a decade, it was undrinkable. We opened another bottle and watched our kids form an impromptu rock band and crank the block rocker, their karaoke machine, up to its loudest setting. The toy guitars and plastic drum set were all super cute, but the noise sent me to the corner of the kitchen, where Elin and Annie and I caught up, wine glasses in hand. "How's work going?" Elin asked, zeroing in on me for some reason. "Things are awesome," I said, which is what I always say, being an innate optimist, along with super or amazing, even if things aren't. I allowed that my job at Hurley was demanding, but becoming a little routine. But it's not like I had the time to do more. Already there weren't enough hours in the day. Annie went next. Her life wasn't any calmer. She had a young daughter at home and no family nearby to help. And her nonprofit was exploding worldwide, while she was also running her own web services and business consulting company. Then it was Elin's turn. She was proud of her Swedish name and background, but to me, a dark-skinned, dark-haired immigrant kid from the Middle East who had garlicky hummus in my school lunches, Elin always seemed like the quintessential all-American girl. I'd envied her fair complexion, gray-green eyes, and light brown curly hair when I was younger, along with her other gifts. In the advanced placement classes we took together at Kimball, Elin had sailed along, getting perfect scores and grades without breaking a sweat, and excelling at the piano at the same time. It's funny how strong these high school impressions can be, because even though I knew from our recent visits that Elin's career had hit the doldrums, I continued to think of her as one step ahead. Always precise with her words, she confessed that she'd relocated from Washington to Michigan to be closer to her family, but working from home felt isolating. She didn't sound that enthusiastic about her projects either. Life had forced too many compromises on her. Maybe being the valedictorian came with unsustainably high expectations. Then she turned to me with a total non sequitur. "What are you hearing about the Flint water?" The question surprised me, as did the abrupt shift in Elin's demeanor. Her eyes were suddenly boring into mine. "I've heard the complaints," I said, "but the state says it's fine, in compliance." "No," she said, shaking her head. "It's really not." Chapter 3. The Valedictorian. Elliot and I had been indoctrinated by our parents. Being an Iraqi host means offering your guests more food than three times as many people could eat. That night was no different. Elliot finally pulled the slightly charred chicken off the grill, and our noisy rock band took a break and wandered toward the heaping platters of food. As soon as we got the kids settled, cutting up their food into kid-sized pieces, Elin and I found each other again. She talked quickly, with intensity and passion. She had seen a memo written by a former colleague of hers, Miguel del Toro, who worked in the Chicago office of the EPA. He had come to Flint a few months before, after being contacted directly by a resident who was concerned about her water. He personally arranged to have an independent test of the tap water in the resident's home. "I worked with Miguel. I know Miguel," Elin said. "I trust him. He wouldn't write this memo if there wasn't a serious problem." "And?" "He says that Flint is not using corrosion control." The urgency on Elin's face was unmistakable, but I was still a little lost. "What is corrosion control?" A shriek rose up in the next room. The posse of kids was already restless and returning to the drum set, guitars, keyboards, and karaoke. "A system of Flint size is required to have corrosion control as part of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Water is naturally corrosive, but water systems are supposed to treat the water to reduce corrosivity. When you change the source of the water or how it's treated, this changes the way the water reacts with the pipes. That's what we learned from the D.C. water crisis." The D.C. water crisis? I didn't think I'd heard of that. The music began again, worse and even louder. Elin and I tucked into a deeper corner of my kitchen. "Whether corrosion is a problem or not depends on what the pipes and plumbing are made of," Elon went on. In Flint, the service lines, the pipes that run from the street into people's homes, are made of lead. And the plumbing inside people's homes has lead, too. Wait a second, I said. Are you saying? Elon nodded. If Miguel's right that Flint is not using corrosion control, that means there's lead in Flint's water. Lead in the water? Elon waited a few moments while I processed the news, then began nodding slowly. And based on Miguel's memo, she went on, the lead levels in the Flint water are really, really high. He suspects that MDEQ isn't testing correctly. That's why he leaked the memo. Are you kidding me? I shook my head. Why would anybody at the EPA need to leak their own memo? Elon cocked her head and just stared at me deadpan. She was waiting for me to catch up. Okay, I said, moving on. So how could the testing not be done right? MDEQ is probably testing for the results they want, which will underestimate the amount of lead in the drinking water. The loopholes in the lead and copper rule allow for that. The utilities do it all the time, trying to game the regulations and manipulate the data to minimize the amount of lead collected in a sample. I don't trust them. I am not naive. I was only 12 when I saw photographs of children who had been poisoned by Saddam Hussein, when he gassed the Kurdish town of Halabja and murdered thousands of his own people. I had nightmares for weeks. I learned then what governments were capable of. But here in Michigan? It was one of those moments when part of your brain whispers, please, can we go back to 5 seconds ago before we knew this? If what Elon was saying was true, it meant my kids, my Flint kids, who were already struggling with so much adversity, were in even greater danger than I'd imagined. I know lead. All pediatricians know lead. It's a powerful, well-studied neurotoxin that disrupts brain development. There is truly no safe level. What about my imagined government scientists with their white lab coats and test tubes? What had happened to them? They were supposed to make sure our water was safe. So far, only one lone bureaucrat seemed to be doing the right thing, and he had to leak the information to get it out. But if Miguel del Toro was right, an entire city was being lied to, and the liars were the very people we trusted to keep us safe. I thought about all the complaints about water in Flint over the past year. The state had answered them with a parade of assurances. Just 5 months before, because of general water quality issues and an outcry from residents, the Flint City Council had voted to return to Detroit water. But Governor Snyder's appointed emergency manager described that decision as incomprehensible and rejected it as too costly. How could money be more important than clean water or the safety of our kids? And just a month ago, the mayor himself had gone on live TV, filled another glass with Flint water for the cameras, smiled, and drunk it. I don't know if I'd ever felt so stunned and disillusioned and sad all at once. What had I done? Where had I been? Baby after baby had come into our clinic. We gave the same advice. It's fine. Yes, it's fine. Drink the water. Of course it's okay. Flint has low breastfeeding rates for a number of reasons. Powdered formula is the norm. To make formula from the powder, you have to mix it with tap water. Meanwhile, for older kids, because of our emphasis on healthy living and lowering sugar in their diets, we were always recommending fewer juices and soda and more water. It's fine. Drink the water. Of course it's okay. When my pediatric residents came to me with questions from patients, I said the same thing, just as I had been taught. Tap water is the best and safest. I drink it. The coffee I mainlined all day was made with it. Flint water. Lead. I thought of Reva and her sweet baby sister, Nicola, who was going to start the shift to powdered formula the week before. How many days had passed? 4 or 5 days of tap water with lead. Little Nicola wouldn't feel any different. The poisoning would be quiet. Lead exposure is known as a silent epidemic because there are no immediate signs of it. But once it was in her bloodstream, the lead would enter her red blood cells and wreak havoc, interfering with the mitochondria, the part of the cell where energy is produced. It would go on to disrupt the formation of the dendrites, disturb the myelin sheath that surrounds nerve fibers, and interrupt the way hemoglobin carries oxygen through Nicola's body. It would settle in her soft tissue and her bones, where it would crowd out calcium. Some heavy metals, iron, copper, zinc, selenium, have health benefits in small amounts, but not lead. It does only harm. Nicola's central nervous system would receive the worst impact from the lead, primarily in her still-developing brain. A significant amount of lead exposure can cause swelling of the brain, headaches, lethargy, anemia, dizziness, muscular paralysis, sleeplessness, loss of appetite, and abdominal pain. It can affect vision and hearing, and in extreme cases, it can cause kidney failure, coma, and death. Even at lower single-digit levels, the damage is irreversible. For an infant like Nicola, or a two-year-old like Riva, enough exposure can mean developmental delays, cognitive impairment, literally a drop in IQ, as well as memory issues, attention, and mood disorders, and aggressive behavior. Brain scans show that lead exposure in children causes an erosion of gray matter that makes it harder to pay attention, regulate emotions, and control impulses. It also affects the white matter of a child's brain, which acts as a conduit for signals within the central nervous system. As lead-poisoned kids reach their teens, they have a much harder time in school and are more likely to drop out. As they reach their 20s, research suggests, they may be more likely to commit violent crime. Lead is even suspected to have an epigenetic or multi-generational impact by changing a child's DNA. It's really science fiction comic book stuff, like the X-Men. Except the victims aren't getting superpowers. Their powers are being taken away. Huddled in our corner of the kitchen, Eel and I continued to talk about the leaked EPA memo. It felt as if a two-person pup tent had dropped over us and the rest of the party had gone away. "I need more wine," I said, and hunted for the open bottle. Lead in the water? Now that I knew the truth, I couldn't unknow it. I could only go forward. "Let's think for a second." "I don't want to sound pessimistic," Elon said, "but you're probably looking at years of fighting this before anything will be done." It was Elon's nature to be cautious and circumspect. When we met, I had been young for ninth grade, only 13, an extrovert who went out for every sport, every activity, every play, and every musical, even though I had limited athletic talent and a pretty terrible voice. Elon was almost a year older, an introvert, with an engineer's mind who looked at life as a series of problems and puzzles to solve, slowly and carefully. She was the kid who read every page of her assigned work and then read all the books that it referenced. By our senior year of high school, I was class president and she was class valedictorian. And while I was perpetually upbeat and talkative, my old friend was, well, kind of ruminative and quiet. Her career had emphasized this even more. Her degrees in environmental science and environmental engineering had led her to work at government bureaucracies where she was always rolling a giant boulder uphill, going against improbable odds, doing endless paperwork exercises, and struggling against political tides. Results came after decades, not after days or months. Something that would have been torture for an impatient person like me. We were both newly married and starting families in the years when she was working at the EPA. She had been scarred by that experience, but I didn't really know how. "I had a bad feeling about Flint from the beginning," she went on, describing a water quality meeting she had attended in Michigan the previous year when she first heard about the water switch. "It was supposed to save Flint money and to be better down the road, or at least that's how it had been explained at the time. It didn't make any financial or engineering sense to change from Lake Huron. Water source changes are very rare. No one goes from a high-quality water source to a lower-quality source unless they are running out of water. And Lake Huron wasn't going anywhere. The infrastructure was all in place. But there was a new requirement that states do an evaluation to make sure that corrosion isn't a factor when a water source change occurs. So I reassured myself with that. Elin's and my longest and deepest bond was environmental activism, something we also shared with my brother. We had been profoundly influenced by Roberta Magid, or Bobby, as we secretly nicknamed her, a feisty progressive New Yorker and high school librarian who was the faculty advisor to our high school environmental club, C. But C was more than a school club. It was a serious real-world undertaking where we learned to strategize and create real change through direct action. Sure, we did the regular stuff of any high school environmental club, like recycling cans and putting on eco-plays for elementary school kids. Mark played an evil trash monster, Elin was Aqua Anastasia, and I was always Mother Earth. But Roberta encouraged us to take it further, to take risks, to put ourselves on the line. We studied activism by becoming activists, going beyond changes in individual behavior to explore how policy and politics helped or hurt our causes. Our biggest undertaking was the Madison Heights incinerator. An elementary school stood in the shadows of its smokestacks, and from soil samples and air quality reports commissioned by a local community group, Clean Air Please, CAP, we learned that the adjacent neighborhood had higher rates of asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. For decades, soot from the incinerator coated these modest working-class homes. The county closed the incinerator for a time, but when it tried to reopen it, we went to the streets with CAP, led by a courageous nurse and single mom, Pam Ortner. A group of us, including Elin, Annie, Mark, and our classmate, Dave Woodward, protested, knocked on doors, and wrote letters. Then we campaigned to elect John Freeman, an environmentalist and lawyer, to the state legislature. Once in office, he added a provision to a state law to make it impossible for an incinerator to operate so close to a school. That was the end of the Madison Heights incinerator. It closed down for good in 1992, our sophomore year of high school. Standing there in the kitchen, I thought back to Roberta and Pam and John and their leadership. How much they had inspired me, how committed they were, and how much they cared. Their activism combined environment, health, and policy at once and made the world a little better. Once you have had a chance to change things, to have a real-world impact, you never forget it. I felt myself tapping back into that powerful feeling, but the urgency and scope of the problem felt overwhelming. Years? But how could this take years to resolve? I asked, incredulous. That is the worst kind of poison. Permanent, life-altering. These kids can't afford another day. I thought Elin was being too pessimistic. Remember what I went through in D.C., she asked. I shook my head. I was embarrassed not to remember an important story from Elin's life that she apparently had told me. But I didn't have the time for apologies at that moment. Remind me. Remember when I left the EPA, she went on, and why I refused to work for D.C. Water? I searched my memory, trying to jar something loose. There was somebody you were trying to stay away from, right? Something like that. Not only did nobody get punished for the D.C. crisis, some were promoted. What you need to know tonight is that basically, scientists and activists tried to prove that children were harmed, but they couldn't get the health data to show it. Lead was in the D.C. water for years. More lead than you can imagine. More lead than I want to think about. This shocked me. Where had I been? D.C. is the worst case scenario, Elin said. They made a treatment change, but didn't study its effect on water quality in advance. When they started measuring high lead in the water, they just kept sampling to try to bring down the system average. But in fact, they kept measuring lead at higher and higher concentrations. And they didn't tell the public. Nothing happened until the Washington Post put the story on the front page 3 years after it started. Even then, the government and utility demanded proof of impact, but never really got it. Proof of impact like... Proof. Like researchers couldn't draw the link between increased lead levels in water and impact on kids. No link, no traction, no link, no action, just a lot of stalling and... She stopped in mid-thought. Wait, aren't you in charge of the hospital in Flint or something like that? No, I'm in charge of the pediatric residents and... But don't you have access to the kids' blood lead tests? Yes, of course I do. Kids on Medicaid are supposed to have their blood lead levels tested at 1 and 2 years of age. My mind began working so quickly, thinking about how to get a hold of the blood data that I'd need, that I forgot to keep up my end of the conversation. Mona. Yeah. I wasn't really hearing her. Mona, listen to me. What? Elin moved very close to me, inches away. Her gray-green eyes were emitting a laser sharpness and energy that would have been scary if I hadn't known her so well. You can do this, she said. Okay. A fog of unreality fell over the rest of the party. Elin's words pinged and echoed in my head as the ragtag rock band devolved into chaos, and two of the littlest kids had very dramatic meltdowns. There were cries and pleas, Mommy, Mommy. It was late, past their bedtimes. We moved our guests quickly to the front door, where I gave everybody a hug and a short goodbye. With difficulty, Elliot put his sling back on. We cleaned up, did the dishes, and went upstairs to put the girls to bed. Chapter 4. Haji. I was distracted, my head still spinning from the conversation with Elin. All I could think about was getting to a computer and searching for papers on lead exposure, on the D.C. water crisis, on water treatment chemicals and their corrosion effects. But Nina and Layla were asking for a bedtime story. They wanted me to tell them Haji and the birds. They usually heard it from my mom or my brother. Oh, I'm not good at telling that story, I said. Come on, Nina said softly. Tell us, Layla insisted. What if I just talked to you about Haji instead, I said. I don't think you remember him. I do, Nina said. Elliot entered the room. Are you telling Haji stories? Yes, the girls called out. Okay, I said, sitting on the edge of the bed with Elliot, all four of us together. Just like you guys are learning a lot of amazing stuff from your grandparents, like how to speak Arabi, make yummy food, and grow a garden, I learned lots of things from Haji. Layla was starting to drift off, but fighting it. Nina, a night owl, was hanging on every word. Haji lived far away in Baghdad, where he had many successes, many jobs and businesses, and where he had so many friends. They were all kinds of people, with different religions and different ethnic backgrounds, Kurds and Jews and Muslims. He was an idealist. Do you remember what that means? It's somebody who believes the world can be better than it is now. Haji had great faith in people, but less faith in religion. Did he go to church? Layla asked. I figured she was curious, because unlike most Chaldean families, we weren't regular churchgoers. No, he didn't. Why not? Well, there's actually a story about that, I said. Tell us that story, Mama. Okay. Layla smiled and settled deeper into her bed. Haji had four brothers. All their names ended in an L. I don't know why. And Haji's real name was Khalil, so his name ended in an L too. He had two sisters. Do you remember their names? One of them was Layla, Layla said. That's right. They were all very creative and started many businesses. One uncle was a lawyer. Another uncle opened a famous bookstore called Dar al-Kutub al-Qadimah, which means the House of Old Books. It was the meeting place for idealists in Baghdad. Another uncle was a prominent chemist who graduated from American University in Beirut, and another became a lawyer. And Haji was a successful businessman who traveled around the world and later became director of Pepsi-Cola in Iraq. But at one time, all the brothers were in business together. They owned a perfume factory. Haji enjoyed tinkering with various oils and scents to create amazing exotic fragrances. He had an amazing nose, I said, touching the tip of Layla's. Later, they made plastic prayer beads and sold them to Shiite pilgrims traveling to the holy cities of Karbala and Najaf. We have a lot of chemists and scientists in our family, don't we? The girls nodded. Because of their reputation for mixing chemicals, during World War II, the British Royal Air Force asked Haji and his brothers for advice. It was so dry and windy in the desert of Iraq, and there were so many sandstorms, that the paint on the British airplanes was peeling off. After some experimentation, Haji and his brothers melted reels of old movie film and mixed it with the paint, and the problem was solved. In addition to keeping the paint from peeling, the brothers' paint recipe seemed to make the planes invisible from the ground and harder to shoot down. Pretty cool, huh? The girls were captivated. Around that time, Haji's perfume factory burned down. He and his brothers lost everything in this fire. As the factory smoldered or burned down to ash, they sat on the corner across the street. They were inconsolable. Do you know what that means? Keep going, Nina said, nodding. But I knew she didn't know what inconsolable meant. They were feeling as sad as they'd ever felt, and unlucky. Nothing could lift their mood. While they were sitting on the corner, a long line of people came to say how sorry they were. All their friends came, their neighbors, the local imams, and a rabbi. Finally, all their employees came to offer words of support and encouragement. Don't give up. Just build a new factory. Haji said that it wasn't possible. He didn't have the energy, and he was feeling too defeated. But the employees kept encouraging him. Don't give up. When Haji said he didn't have the money to build a new factory, the employees offered him money. How much do you need? They asked. One by one, they began handing him Iraqi dinars. This impressed Haji so much. The employees had little money of their own, but they wanted to help. Afterward, whenever he told the story of his perfume factory burning down, he would cry. He was moved by the goodness of his friends and employees. Their generosity consoled him, made him feel better. It helped him to be brave and rebuild, and he was no longer sad. Layla looked at me sideways. Ha! But he noticed that none of the Iraqi priests offered him help or support, or even a kind word. One priest told Haji that the fire was God's punishment for his arrogance. He said that Haji believed in people more than in God. Haji stopped going to church after that. He said he would never step in a church again. Never? Nina asked. Almost never, I said. But you know, what the priest said was true. Haji did believe in people more than anything else, and they believed in him. He was a humanist, someone who believes that people can make the world better. Haji respected everyone's beliefs and never spoke against any religion. But he didn't believe that God wanted calamity for anyone, or that anyone deserved to be abandoned to fate or bad luck. He taught me to treat everybody well, because we are all equal, no matter what we look like, what we believe in, or how much money we have. To always do the right thing, even if it is hard. Even if people tell you it's impossible. And maybe that's even better than going to church. I looked over at Elliot, who was now smiling too, remembering Haji. Even today, I went on, kids and grandkids of Haji's employees reach out to us, totally out of the blue, to tell their Haji stories. And they always mention his generosity. So their gratitude is passed down through stories and extends to us, even to you, Haji's great-granddaughters. Because Haji's actions in life and things he believed in left a mark on us all, even though we can't see it. Chapter 5. Red Flags. After the girls finally fell asleep, hours passed, a blur of time in the dark with only the brightness of my iPad screen. As soon as Elin arrived home and put her kids to bed, she had sent me a long email with links to Wikipedia pages, Centers for Disease Control, CDC reports, and EPA memos. I was up for 3 or 4 hours in bed, deluged by reports about water quality, water testing, water treatments, water pipe corrosion, and lead. Totally consumed, I forgot to sleep. From time to time, I heard Elliot shifting. He was restless, trying to sleep in a big recliner that we'd borrowed from my parents and hauled up to the corner of our bedroom. The barbecuing had probably been too much for his shoulder. He was in pain and hooked up to an ice machine. Usually the continuous vibratory hum and pumping sounds were hypnotic and put me to sleep, but not tonight. He asked me what Elin and I had been so intensely talking about. I thought he might have overheard something, but I didn't want to get into it. I said quickly, "Oh, nothing, nothing." He knew me well enough to let it go. From Elin Betanzo to Mona Hannah Atisha. Sent August 26, 2015, 11:57 p.m. Subject, lead in drinking water and Flint. Hi, Mona. Here's a lot of information about what I understand about the drinking water in Flint and a comparison to what happened in Washington, D.C. I'd be happy to help you wade through it if you'd like. If you know of any ways that I could help out in Flint, let me know. As the hours passed, I was stunned by how Elin had anticipated the water problems before they'd begun. The year before, when she learned about the water switch, she had offered her expertise as an independent water quality engineer to help ensure that the new water supply was safe. But she had been turned down, told she wasn't needed. She was told everything was fine. I started my reading with a few stories by Ron Funger, an intrepid reporter at the Flint Journal and MLive.com, its online platform. Funger had done a solid job covering the water switch, the residents' concerns and their activism, the parade of assurances from the city and state. But it felt as if nobody had been listening or paying attention. Not the people in power, anyway. I moved on to a series of articles by Detroit investigative reporter Kurt Guyette, who had been assigned to cover the emergency manager story for the Michigan chapter of the ACLU, with funding from the Ford Foundation. Their concern was that citizens' right to self-government might be usurped by a state-appointed EM. The collaboration between the ACLU and the Ford Foundation was a first for both of them, a philanthropic effort to fill the gap in costly investigative work that traditional media could no longer afford. Guyette had been a skeptic about the water source switch all along. He dogged officials with questions they never answered, or at least not to his satisfaction. He tried to dig deeper into the story but didn't really find answers until the EPA memo was leaked to him. In July 2015, he posted a news story on the ACLU blog and Deadline Detroit, releasing the memo to the public. The memo, an 8-page interim report written by Miguel Del Toro, Elin's former colleague and the regulations manager of the Midwest Water Division of the EPA, was methodically detailed, science-driven, and shocking. The words "high lead levels in Flint" were right there at the top, in the subject line under the official EPA letterhead. Honestly, that alone should have been enough to stop everyone in their tracks. It should have prompted the state to study and fix the situation, and most important, alert the public. You don't mess around with lead or even the suspicion of lead. Any pediatrician will tell you the same thing. The split second this memo saw the light of day, a state of emergency should have been called, and the governor should have asked for federal help. But somehow, here I was in bed, my hair on fire, fully 2 months later, reading about it for the first time. Del Toro's report described water testing in the home of Leanne Walters, a 37-year-old mother of four and military spouse who lived on Browning Avenue on Flint's south side. Just a few months after the water source switch in 2014, Walters noticed that her 3-year-old twins, Gavin and Garrett, broke out in red bumps after they were given a bath. Gavin had immune deficiencies and was especially prone to problems. If he soaked in the bathtub for a long time, a scaly rash would form across his chest at the waterline. As Kurt Guyette's stories described, even after the city lifted its boil alerts and officially announced that the bacterial content in the water was in compliance with federal guidelines, the Walters family continued to experience rashes, along with abdominal pain and bizarre hair loss. Leanne's eyelashes were disappearing. Her 18-year-old daughter, Kaylee, was taking a shower when a clump of her hair fell out in her hand. And even more troubling, according to a Gaiet story, Gavin had stopped growing. 9 months after the water switch, in January 2015, Walters went to her first city council meeting. The following month, a city employee was sent to test the water in her house. Prior to taking a sample, the employee ran the tap for a few minutes, explaining that he was following MDEQ guidelines to pre-flush. This struck Walters as strange. If there was something in the water to worry about, wouldn't whatever it was get flushed out too? People don't usually flush tap water before they drink it. Even with flushing, the sample came back showing an astronomically high amount of lead in Walter's water. Particles and metals in water are measured in parts per billion, PPB, and the lead in Walter's water tested at nearly 400 PPB. Based on the latest scientific studies, the maximum amount of lead that should be allowable in water is 0 PPB. Even the EPA agrees. But the official action level, the amount of lead that warrants some sort of action be taken, is set at 15 ppb. The memo stated that Walters took her children to the doctor for testing that revealed elevated lead levels in their blood. When Walters notified the city of her children's high blood lead levels, she was told that her household plumbing must be to blame, since the tests of city water showed lead levels in compliance with regulations. The city arranged for a garden hose to run from a neighbor's house to Walter's house to provide lead-free water. A few days later, Governor Snyder's office issued a statement that the Flint system was producing water that met all the state and federal standards. Walters was not reassured. For starters, when she first moved into her house, she had discovered that all the copper pipes had been stripped and stolen, not uncommon in Flint. That had forced her to install all new plumbing made of polyvinyl chloride, PVC, a strong but lightweight plastic. She had told this to the city employee when he came to test. If all her pipes were made of plastic, how could they be leaching lead? Frustrated, she contacted the regional EPA headquarters in Chicago and eventually reached Miguel del Toro. According to Elin, only a handful of people in the drinking water universe were as careful and knew as much as Del Toro. During her years at the EPA, where she wrote new regulations for the Safe Drinking Water Act, she worked closely with him on a disinfectant byproducts work group. As a member of that work group, Del Toro had a reputation for high standards, extra vigilance, and immunity to the pressures of groupthink. He raised concerns about drinking water regulations that everybody else dismissed or overlooked. Finally, here he was, my idealized, lab coat-wearing, public health civil servant come to life. He didn't mind conflict and was unafraid to go his own way. By the time Walter spoke to Del Toro on the phone, she had searched the web to educate herself thoroughly about water treatment and had come to some conclusions. She told Del Toro she suspected the Flint water supply was corrosive and the pipes were leaching lead. She questioned whether the city was using corrosion control. Del Toro found it hard to believe that the city wasn't using corrosion control and asked Walters to read him the list of chemicals that were used to treat Flint's water, as posted on the city website. When she was finished, he asked her to read him the list again, just to make sure he'd heard her correctly. Not using corrosion control was a breach of federal law. There were no corrosion control chemicals on the city list. He followed up with MDEQ immediately, but his calls and emails didn't get him anywhere. No action was taken to correct the problem. Next, in April 2015, Del Toro traveled from Chicago to Flint to investigate Walter's house himself. First, he thoroughly examined the plumbing, the pipes the city officials had described as the likely source of lead. As his memo states, his inspection of Leanne Walters' home found that all the interior plumbing, including the pipes, valves, and connectors, was made of plastic certified by the National Sanitation Foundation, NSF, for use in drinking water applications. Del Toro's sampling showed that the faucets were also not the source of the high lead levels. On his second visit, in May 2015, Del Toro deduced that the problems weren't inside the house, but in a service line that led to it. When he extracted portions of the line and discovered it was made of galvanized iron and lead. Del Toro also found the pre-flushing procedure done at Walter's house prior to sampling very troubling. Pre-flushing was known to result in a minimization of lead capture and significant underestimation of lead levels in the drinking water, according to his memo. This was a serious concern because the results could provide a false sense of security to the residents of Flint regarding lead levels in the water and may result in residents not taking necessary precautions to protect their families from lead in the drinking water. But when he raised his concern with MDEQ, the department pushed back. Pre-flushing was not specifically prohibited by federal law or by the lead and copper rule, which governed drinking water. The department said it planned to continue the practice. His conclusion. The pipes serving the Walters home were leaching lead. MDEQ was using faulty testing procedures, and Flint wasn't using corrosion control. He included the blood lead levels of the four Walters children as evidence of impact, and he predicted that Flint could be facing an epic water crisis. He recommended that the EPA offer the city an MDEQ technical assistance. He directed his report to Thomas Poy, chief of the Groundwater and Drinking Water Division of the EPA, but seven other individuals were copied, including two other employees at the EPA and four officials at MDEQ. The report was dated June 24, 2015. Something truly disturbing happened after that. Rather than generating an instant response to the potential crisis outlined, Del Toro's findings were second-guessed. Rather than seriously investigating the matter as quickly as possible as any responsible federal agency would, the EPA stalled, then reprimanded Del Toro for overstepping his responsibilities and referred him to the agency's ethics office. At MDEQ, the memo was met with even more resistance and hostility. State regulators painted Del Toro as a lone wolf, and alarmist, a rogue employee, who had grossly exceeded his authority. Embarrassed, the regional manager at the EPA even apologized to MDEQ for Del Toro's memo, describing it as premature and incomplete. Seeing no alternative, Del Toro, still defiant, gave Walters a copy of his findings, which she passed along to Kurt Guyette, who broke the story on July 9, 2015. Elin and I exchanged texts and emails while I read. Sometimes she answered my questions in quips and scientific shorthand, but mostly we expressed ourselves in words of disbelief and angry emojis. The more I knew, the angrier I became. I was mad at myself for not paying attention to the repeated outcries of the Flint activists, and even angrier at all levels of government for their lack of response and their gross indifference. Red flags. So many red flags. They were everywhere. The information was all right there in Del Toro's memo. But somehow, nobody with the power to make a difference had cared enough to notice. Looking back over the summer, I saw how I had been caught up in my own busy bubble, dealing with a new crop of pediatric residents on July 1st, and Elliot's shoulder surgery in mid-July, followed by the opening of our brand-new Hurley Children's Clinic, which we celebrated with an open house on August 7th. We began receiving patients just a few days later. To make the summer more complicated, Layla's birthday was August 14th, and I planned her party and the annual Hurley Pediatric Beach Party for the same summer weekend. These are my excuses. But the truth was, after a year of concern about Flint's water being brown and smelly, and a year of assurances from officials, I'd failed to notice the dust storm caused by Guyette's pieces, and I had only a faint memory of government assurances about the water and Mayor Walling drinking a glass of it on television. But while I was consumed by the day-to-day distractions of my family and work projects, other people in Flint were speaking out. Moms, activists, pastors, and even our kids. They were organized and vocal. Why wasn't anyone in government listening to them? Was it because they were poor and predominantly black? Or was it because there was no reason for the government to listen to the people because Flint was no longer a democracy? The city was in the hands of an unelected EM who was accountable to the governor, not to the people of the city. I quickly ran the numbers in my head. Flint had about 10,000 children under the age of 6. Many of them were our patients. Over the last year, we had treated thousands of Flint kids for winter coughs and summer sniffles, for strep, broken bones, and fevers. We weighed them all, checked their ears, and listened to their heartbeats carefully. We asked their moms if they were getting proper nutrition. We discussed obesity, drugs, and violence in the community. We gave them immunizations, and when they needed help navigating the system, referrals to social workers. We tried to help them get to their appointments with transportation assistance. Being a pediatrician, perhaps more than any other kind of doctor, means being an advocate for your patient. It means using your voice to speak up for kids. We are charged with the duty of keeping these kids healthy. We took an oath. Where had we been? Where had I been? Now I was wondering whether I'd ever sleep or eat again. If you want to get really motivated, Elon wrote in an email, look at the Wikipedia page on the DC crisis. Okay. You'll see what you're up against. Washington, D.C. is a mecca for recent college graduates. Entry-level jobs and internships in politics, nonprofits, and government are plentiful. And promotions can happen quickly. Elon's career was a vertical blur, as far as I could tell. And it was because Elon was in D.C. that we had stayed in close touch over the years. She lived only a few houses away from my brother, in the crunchy suburb of Tacoma Park. Her first job, right after graduating from Carnegie Mellon, was at the U.S. Patent Office. But after a year, she found a job at the EPA, where she really wanted to be. The concept of environmental protection really meant something to her, as it had since our high school days of activism. The position, she was hired to write annual reports for the EPA's chief financial planner, wasn't exactly what she wanted, but she thought it would get her foot in the door, and something better would follow. But years passed, and for all her promotions up the bureaucratic ladder, nothing did. September 11th woke her up and pushed her to do more meaningful work. It was time to do some real environmental protection, not just paperwork for government contracts. She got the word out among EPA friends and learned that the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water had some new positions for engineers. Protecting drinking water, that sounded like important work. In 2002, she began a new job in that office while taking classes part-time at the Northern Virginia campus of Virginia Tech, working toward a master's degree in environmental engineering. But the job turned out mostly to mean writing more regulations for the Safe Drinking Water Act that would take years to propose, finalize, and implement. It was a time of seismic shifts in water treatment, when cities across the country were switching disinfectants, not only to combat a broader range of pathogens, but also to limit the effects of chlorine and its carcinogenic byproducts, like TTHMs. A public health triumph, drinking water treatment has saved countless lives from persistent menaces like E. coli and halted deadly epidemics of cholera. But now there were new threats, noroviruses, and something called cryptosporidium, or crypto. Cryptosporidium, a microscopic parasite that wreaks havoc on the digestive and respiratory tracts of human beings, is not effectively removed from contaminated water by chlorine. So the EPA decided it needed to create better drinking water treatment rules. Many cities turned from chlorination to chloramination. As a disinfectant, chloramine lasts longer than chlorine, is effective against crypto, and doesn't create as many toxic byproducts. By 1998, in order to comply with the new EPA regulations, an estimated 68 million Americans were drinking water disinfected with chloramine, and several major cities, including Washington, D.C., were using it. But there were problems, as there are with any disinfectant, depending on the amounts used, the mix of other disinfectants, and composition and quality of the source water. Water treatment is an art, Elon wrote in a text. Me, I'm starting to get that. Elon, it's complicated. Me, I get that too. Elon, every time they tweak the rules, some new thing pops up. The problem, Chloramines made the water much more corrosive, an unforeseen consequence that didn't come to light for several years. By that time, the corrosion had leached toxic levels of lead for years. The DC water story broke in an alternative news weekly, the Washington City Paper, on October 18, 2002, through the story of a resident of American University Park whose water tested very high for lead, 6 to 18 times the EPA action level. The EPA scientist overseeing DC's water at the time suggested that drought conditions could have raised the alkaline levels of the Potomac River, which would make the water temporarily more corrosive and cause the service lines to leach lead into the water. It was thought that there were about 35,000 lead service lines serviced by the city's water utility company, DC Water and Sewer Authority, WASA. A plan was implemented to replace 7% of those lines each year until the lead levels dropped. That was the official plan anyway. Nobody questioned it until the following year, when WASA hired Mark Edwards, a young professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech, to look into the inexplicable increase in pinhole leaks in copper water pipes in the DC area. It was even happening in new copper pipes, which were supposed to last 50 years. Edwards, an expert in copper corrosion with a degree in biophysics, began researching the rise in these strange leaks. Out of curiosity, Edwards decided to do a test for lead, suspecting that a chemical change in the water could be causing deterioration of the DC pipes. As he would later recount at congressional oversight hearings, the level of lead on his first test exceeded his meter's range. He had to dilute the water and test again. When he did, even the diluted water tested at a minimum of 1,250 ppb of lead, a level that Edwards later said would literally have to be classified as a hazardous waste. Edwards had stumbled by accident onto the unforeseen consequences of the new EPA regulations, the very ones that Elon's office had been working on. The switch to chloramine, now required by Safe Drinking Water Act regulations, caused increased corrosiveness in the water. Old service lines had been coated with decades of accumulated mineral deposits that formed a protective coating inside the pipes. But that protective layer was now being stripped by the corrosive water, and lead was leaching out. A cover-up was already underway. When Edwards brought his findings and concerns to WASA, he was told his funding and future access to monitoring data would be cut off. At the EPA, his subcontract was discontinued. Other engineers who drew attention to the toxic lead levels and recommended the utility and the EPA take much more aggressive action, like WASA water quality manager Seema Bhatt, were fired. Elon attended the first few meetings in 2003 to address the elevated lead levels, and when she began asking a lot of questions, she was mysteriously removed from the project and promoted to another division within the agency. Weeks, months, and finally years passed. Lead flowed freely and in heavy amounts in all four quadrants of the district, from Georgetown and Spring Valley to the farthest reaches of Georgia Avenue and Anacostia. It affected infants, children, and adults, rich, poor, and gentrified, working middle and upper class, white and black. Both WASA and the EPA knew and did nothing. In January 2004, the Washington Post published its first story, reporting on the elevated water lead levels uncovered by Edwards. At this point, not even the DC mayor and council members had been told. In response, WASA issued a health advisory to pregnant women and young children in homes with lead service lines. But high water lead levels were later found in homes with copper service lines, too. As Edwards testified to Congress in March 2004, the corrosive water was leaching lead not just from the old lead service lines outside homes, but from brass fixtures inside homes as well. It turned out that brass fixtures, even when marketed as lead-free by the manufacturer, could still contain an average of 8% lead. That wouldn't change until a new regulation took effect in 2014. As the evidence became public and overwhelming, EPA and WASA administrators hunkered down, more interested in self-preservation than in public health. These agencies were joined by the CDC.